Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute where we offer a skeptical take on U.S. foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Emma Ashford. In September, shots were fired in Ladakh, the high-altitude border region between China and India, for the first time in decades. It's certainly not the first violence in the region. Even a 1990s agreement to remove guns and explosives from the border wasn't enough to prevent the deaths of 20 Indian soldiers at the border in June. Instead, they were reportedly bludgeoned to death. But the use of firearms in the region in recent weeks marks a new phase of heightened tensions. More broadly, we're seeing increased tensions between China and India, as well as between China and others of its regional neighbors. The move raises key questions of what is China seeking from its neighbors, and more broadly, what is China's regional security strategy? So joining me today to discuss Chinese strategy and the ongoing tensions between China and India is Taylor Fravel. Taylor is the Arthur and Ruth Sloan Professor of Political Science and the Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. His work focuses on military strategy and on East Asia. Taylor, welcome to Power Problems.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so can we start with the disputes on the China-India border? Can you give us a little overview of what's happening? Because it seems like every time I sort of read an article about this, it is full of so many details that it's hard to actually get a picture of what's going on for people that don't know that area well.
Sure, yeah. No, it's actually quite a complicated dispute with a long history, as you sort of hinted at in the introduction. So let me just make a couple of points here, and I'm going to start from sort of the widest possible angle and then zoom in. And unfortunately, because this is a podcast, I can't show you maps. That would make it easier. But just sort of, I think you'll be able to follow along as I sort of try to delineate the nature of the disputes. So the very largest level, or the most macro level, it's important to start with the recognition, right, that India and China dispute approximately 125,000 kilometers of territory. So this is where they have overlapping sovereignty claims. Starting in the east, you have what's known as the eastern sector of this dispute, also described as the state of Arunachal Pradesh, more or less. China's claims more or less overlap here with the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh. Again, it's 90,000 square kilometers in size. And this territory is almost entirely under India's control and has been for quite some time. Then you have sort of the central or middle sector. This is roughly, say, 2,000 square kilometers in size. Control here is kind of divided evenly between India and China. And then you have the western sector, which has been the focus of where acts have been happening lately. And this is about 33,000 square kilometers in size. And it's almost entirely under China's control. So basically, you have one large chunk of territory to the east that's under Indian control and another large chunk of territory to the west that's under Chinese control. From the Indian point of view, the western sector is even bigger because India includes territory that was given to China in a 1963 sort of temporary boundary agreement between China and Pakistan. But for our purposes, let's just call it 33,000 square kilometers. And here, there is no agreed upon border. There's something called the line of actual control, in fact, in all three sectors. And this has sort of emerged over time based loosely on kind of a military separation line from the 1962 war, and then sort of more or less where each side had kind of de facto control. And where we are today is basically the fact that the Western sector has become much more tense and volatile. And this started in sort of late April to early May. China, from its point of view, moved up to the line of control in three or four areas in the Western sector. And from India's point of view, moved over the line of actual control. Because here, and especially in the Western sector, the two sides don't necessarily view the line of control as lying in the same place. There are, I think, now as many as 25 areas where the two sides actually don't view the line of actual control as being in the exact same place. And so one key hotspot was known as Pangong Lake, which we'll talk more about in just a minute. Then you had what's known as Gorga and Hot Springs, which are two areas quite close to each other. Then you had the Galwan Valley, which is where there was a deadly clash on the evening of June 15th. And then finally, you have a variety of positions where China and India have been sort of deploying forces and perhaps across the line of actual control known as Depsang. And even within Depsang, there's basically the plains area and then the bottleneck or Y junction. I realize that's a mouthful to get us started. But basically, after the deadly clash on the evening of June 15th, there was an initial move by both sides to disengage. It sort of stalled over the summer. And at the end of August, sort of the 29th to the 31st, roughly, India moved forces into as many as perhaps six locations on the north and the south side of Pangong Lake. Sort of the Indian sort of official view is that they were preempting a Chinese move. It's not entirely clear what the Chinese move was, since it was preemptive, but there was certainly an increase of Chinese forces in this area. And what India basically did was to occupy sort of the high ground, overlooking a variety of Chinese positions. And so it sort of upped the ante, so to speak, and in many ways was doing to China what India believed China had done to it in earlier in the summer. But now the situation is quite tense. News reports suggest that there may be as many as 50,000 soldiers deployed from each side, either on the line of actual control or in close proximity to the line of actual control, such that they could be used in a military conflict. And in many of these positions now, in sort of north and south of Pangong Lake, you know, there are reports that in some cases, forces are only a couple hundred meters apart. And of course, warning shots have been fired repeatedly within the past week in this area too. So it's exceptionally tense and volatile. And so the proximate causes of conflict are these very specific areas, and currently Pangong Lake in the western sector. But the dispute itself is much broader and really comprises, I think it makes it one of the world's largest territorial disputes today.
Yeah, so hold on to that thought, actually, because in a minute I want to ask you to zoom back out to that question of why this is happening on a sort of bigger level. But I did also want to ask, so my understanding is that this area is very sort of high up in the mountains, not particularly passable in many cases, that especially come winter, this is not a place where you're going to see any kind of large-scale fighting. So I guess one question is the extent to which this could actually devolve into fighting, you know, in that location in which it could spread. It seems like it would have to remain relatively small if it remained localized.
Great question. So many of these areas are at altitude. Some of these mountain peaks, I want to say, are 18, 19, maybe even 20,000 feet tall, right? That is high. I once myself hiked in Nepal, and I got to about 17,500 feet. And although not being a mountaineer, it was incredibly exhausting just trying to put one foot, you know, in front of the other. So this is, in some cases, especially if you're trying to occupy the high ground, you really actually are literally very high up. That said, you know, in the area south of Pangong Lake, a lot of attention is focused on what's known as the Spongor Gap. And this was a scene of intense fighting in October, November of 1962. It's at slightly lower elevation. The high ground that India has occupied in some ways is meant to dominate the Chinese positions or the routes that Chinese forces might take through this gap. What this means is, and the second point I want to make, is that over the last, you know, really since 1962, but especially in the last 2 to 3 decades, China and India, both in different ways, have tried to really improve infrastructure in these areas, primarily in terms of all-weather roads that they could use, and not just in the summer months or the campaigning season in the Himalayas, but actually all year round. And so I think what this means is that the campaigning season itself really has until about mid-November. So we have, I think, 2 months that are still quite dangerous. I think when winter comes, it will certainly make large-scale military operations much more difficult for both sides to conclude. And so I think the speculation now is that if there is no major fighting between now and, say, mid-November, that you'll see both sides kind of consolidate their positions, try to keep what they've taken or areas that they've occupied in the last few months, and then fortify them to the best of their ability, such that when spring of 2021 rolls around, we'll more or less be returning to the situation as it was before winter came.
Oh, well, that's a comforting thought. Okay, so but I want to come back to this bigger question, right? Because you keep mentioning the war in the early 1960s. And, you know, obviously not much has happened kind of since that time, you know, small scale violence. So I'm a little confused about why this is getting out of hand right now. It seems like really the last thing either side needs is a conflict during coronavirus, frankly, a conflict at all, particularly over a fairly small section as you put it, sort of as of the overall disputed border territories. So why is this happening now?
So I think there are a bunch of reasons, and I can focus a little bit more on the China side, since I know that's what you'd like to talk about. But the first reason I think applies to both, and it goes back to what I mentioned a minute ago, which is namely greatly enhanced border infrastructure. And so these areas were really remote. And in the 1960s, they were hard to access. You literally had to walk into many of them. You couldn't drive in. And now, of course, in many of these areas, there are all-weather roads on both sides. India, in early 2019, completed what's known as the DSDVO road, which basically connects or runs along more or less most of the western sector from an airfield called Dalit Beg Oldie up near the tri-junction with Pakistan all the way down to near the Pongal Lake. That's greatly facilitated India's movements across or laterally along the line of actual control. And China, for its part, has also been trying to build more roads and infrastructure. What this means, though, is that in the last decade, especially in the last 5 years, the ability of both sides to patrol areas where they dispute the location of the line of actual control has increased. And so in some ways, the dispute has been given a new lease on life, paradoxically enough, because the efforts sort of to improve border area infrastructure have actually brought to the surface many areas of disagreement that were basically dormant after 1962. And this is one reason why I think the confidence building measures from the early 1990s are not really necessarily that well suited to the current situation anymore, because they were agreed upon at a time when both sides didn't really frequently come into contact with each other. In a very general level, you have sort of infrastructure, and China here has had the upper hand. India has been catching up, but the net result has been both sides are trolling more frequently than ever before. And you actually see this quite frequently referred to now in Indian press reports of what's happening on the border. I think China, for its part, has its own sort of motivations and concerns. And there are a couple that I'd list. First, we'll just start with Xi Jinping and the more strident approach to sovereignty that he has pushed China to pursue under his leadership of the Chinese Communist Party and China more generally. We see this in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, right? All of China's remaining territorial disputes have certainly only become sort of more tense under Xi Jinping, right? Now, thankfully, most of China's territorial disputes were settled in previous periods, but those disputes that remain, especially the maritime ones, Taiwan, India, are a series of hotspots or friction points around China's periphery. Then you have 2017, and this is when India sent forces into what it viewed to be Bhutanese territory, what China viewed to be Chinese territory, basically at the tri-junction of India, Bhutan, and China, to stop China from building a road as part of the infrastructure drive that we talked a minute ago about. I think this really took China by surprise. It took China by surprise in part because India moved forces into an area that it didn't even claim to be Indian. It was sort of acting on Bhutan's behalf to help protect sort of a de facto sort of client state of Bhutan. And although there was a lull in 2018, if we look at sort of Indian reports of Chinese transgressions of the line of actual control, so incidents when China crosses what India views to be the line of actual control, not actually crossing necessarily beyond what China views to be the line of actual control, they really have increased in the last 2 years, and especially in the Western sector. Which is not necessarily surprising, because this is one area where I think India has made a big effort to improve its position, and it's trying to sort of to counteract China's dominant position there. But I think the takeaway from 2017 and the standoff over Doklam is that China didn't really want to be surprised again. Fast forward to the summer of 2019. I know this is probably more information than you want, but it's complicated, so we have to go through everything. There was a move in India to bifurcate the state of Jammu and Kashmir into two federally administered union territories. One of these was Ladakh. And in October, when it was late, or perhaps it was early November, I can't quite remember, India then published a new map of this new union territory of Ladakh. And of course, it showed the entire Western sector as being part of India, even though this is all occupied by China. It And I think from China's point of view, it's really seen as hardening kind of India's position in the dispute, especially in the context of improved infrastructure. A few months before this map was released, the Home Minister, Amit Shah, made a very strong comments in the Indian Parliament about sort of retaking Ladakh and being willing to die for it and everything else. And so whether or not this was intended to be sort of as a signal to China, China viewed it as a sort of increased sort of a commitment of India's resolve to sort of defend its claims in the dispute. And then fast forward to the sort of the spring of 2020, I think some of the details here are a little fuzzy. It looks like China decided to move into some of these areas, but also that India had not at least expeditiously mounted kind of counter patrols. And thus China found itself with the ability to sort of push westward in several locations up to what it views to be the line of actual control.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, so that is a lot of detail. But it sounds like the situation that we're in basically is sort of increasingly hardening positions on either side, rising tensions. And, you know, anyone that's sort of studied military history knows that that is not a great place to be in. I'm interested in talking a little more about the Chinese side of this. So you argued in a foreign affairs article a couple of months back that this conflict has to do on the Chinese side a lot with their growing obsession with sovereignty. You know, and you talk about various places in East Asia, not just this border dispute in particular. And so I wondered if I could ask you to expand a little on that. You know, talk about why is sovereignty suddenly so important to Xi Jinping, to the Chinese Communist Party? How is it informing their foreign policy today?
Sure, that's a great question. Although I do want to note, I did not choose the title for my foreign affairs article. and I probably would not have chosen that particular title. Because the point I was trying to make was that, one, I already mentioned to you, namely, right, that just overall, Xi Jinping has adopted, or China under Xi Jinping has adopted a much more strident approach to sovereignty. And you know, this goes all the way back to early March of 2013, when Xi gives a speech talking about the China dream and links kind of the defense of Chinese sovereignty and territory with achieving the China dream, right? So if the China dream is this very large overarching kind of framework for China's diplomacy, even if it's mostly internally oriented, it really did elevate the importance of sovereignty. I think fast forward to, so as I mentioned, right, you've seen China pushing in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea in particular, right, both of these under Xi Jinping's watch, you know, the Coast Guard patrols around the Senkaku Islands, the oil rig in the South China Sea, land reclamation, militarization of the features and so forth. And then in the context of this, of course, you also have a growing number of incidents along the China-India border in 2013 and 2014, in addition to what we talked about a moment ago in terms of 2017. In the context of the sort of backlash against China in the spring of 2020 with the spread of the coronavirus pandemic, I think sovereignty became sort of even more important for China. I think at that time, when a lot of this sort of this new phase of assertiveness happened, China felt like it was on its back foot. Relations with the United States were plummeting. The economy was in trouble. And I think at this point, China's leaders concluded they certainly could not afford to look weak on sovereignty issues, both for their domestic audiences as well as for international audiences. And so I think this sort of just made sort of defending sort of Chinese sovereignty claims even more important than they already were. I think this helps us better understand why we've seen so much assertiveness in the spring of 2020.
So a lot of your broader work is on kind of defense policies, threat perceptions. You know, your book, I think it was last year your book came out, and it was about why China has sort of reoriented its defense policies over the decades. And so what we've been talking about, obviously, is a kind of a change in strategy, a change in approach to the world. I'm wondering if that has been matched on the Chinese side by change in defense policies, change in posture, approach to the region.
So I think China's defense posture today bears many important elements of continuity with a modernization plan that was really put in place in 1999 after the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Kosovo. The accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Kosovo is part of the Kosovo air war. And this is when basically a recapitalization of the PLA overall as an organization was approved by the Chinese leadership. And now we're, you know, basically 2 decades later, right? We're seeing the fruits of this modernization from China's point of view in terms of the really impressive number of new and modern platforms that have been inducted into the Chinese Air Force, the Navy, and the Ground Force. The reason why I want to say there's a lot of continuity, though, is that this modernization effort was part of a strategy to help the PLA to prevail in what are described as local wars, or in Chinese, Zhubu Zhanzheng. And these basically refer to conflicts on China's periphery where sovereignty is disputed for the most part. One could also imagine perhaps a local war on the Korean Peninsula in the case of kind of a collapse of the North, but primarily, you know, sort of the pacing threat here for China was Taiwan. South China Sea and East China Sea became more important. But of course, India was never forgotten because it is really an important part of kind of China's strategic periphery. And so in this sense, I still think you see more continuity in China's approach, but basically China's just in a much more capable position to sort of be able to prevail in these conflicts than it was when it started. And if this is true, then of course it would also explain in part China's assertiveness, because it believes that it can certainly sort of brandish force in a deterrent way, perhaps much more readily or easily than before, because it can be confident necessarily that it might be able to deter escalation, especially from smaller and weaker countries. Of course, with India, right, this has probably backfired. I think India now has decided it's time to stand up to China before China gets too strong. And if you sort of read the Indian press and Indian accounts of what's going on, you really get a sense that India, in some ways, or at least within the commentary in India, there's sort of a desire to give China a bloody nose, right? I wouldn't want to characterize the official Indian position in that way. I think it's much more sort of nuanced and moderate, and I wouldn't even necessarily characterize all of the commentary that way, but certainly you can read a lot of these commentaries like, oh yeah, you know, in the end of August when we seized the commanding heights, we got revenge, and you know, so on and so forth, right? And so but overall, right, this military strategy still is focused on East Asia. It's not a global strategy. And I think it will take some time before it would ever become a global strategy. Taiwan is the pacing threat. Dealing with the United States in the region, in a Taiwan conflict in particular, is a key part of that. And this paradoxically suggests that China may not necessarily want to push much harder on the border with India, because, of course, it doesn't want to find itself in a two-front sort of conflict situation. And even though, you know, sort of the East Asian, Western Pacific elements or contingencies for China are primarily air and naval campaigns, and the West or India is primarily sort of a ground force campaign. Nevertheless, Chinese writing or Chinese military writings focus a lot on basically this need to prevent a kind of two-front war situation and be able to basically control conflict in one area that may be less important, like India, to be able to focus on the most important area, which, of course, is Taiwan today.
You know, that's a really interesting point you made a few minutes ago that I think we don't hear repeated enough in some of the conversation about sort of China and Washington, which is that China is not in nearly as good a strategic position as the United States is, just from a geographical point of view, from a geostrategic point of view. You know, China has multiple fronts that it still has to consider when it's actually building up its defense capabilities, when it's considering whether it could mount conflicts. You know, it really does have to bear in mind that it's got sort of a variety of threats in different areas. But I guess, so kind of related to that, there's been a lot of conversation in Washington about this this notion of the Quad, right? That the US would form some kind of larger alliance with, I think right now it's what, Australia, Japan, and India is the Quad. But the idea that the US might start to align more forcefully with these other countries that are themselves aligning against China. And I would just love to get your thoughts on that. I hear a variety of opinions on whether it's plausible or not.
Well, I think it depends, you know, or how to answer that question. It really depends on what you mean by the Quad, right? Would this become like an Indo-Pacific NATO? It's like, of course not, right? That like like that would just be far-fetched. And I can't see India or Japan really wanting to sign up to that, even though they have real concerns with China, and those real concerns with China overlap with American concerns. So I think what you are certainly seeing, though, is China in the last 8 to 10 years has, in various ways, really needled some of its important neighbors, to include Japan over the Senkaku Islands, but also other maritime-related issues. India on the border, despite efforts by Modi and Xi Jinping at Wuhan in 2018 to overcome that. And then, of course, Australia. And, you know, the Australian is less of a direct, perhaps, sort of military threat, but certainly this view that China is unduly meddling in Australian society at the expense, in a very fundamental way, of sort of Australian autonomy. And so China is bringing these countries together. And that much is true. What that will mean in practice in terms of coordinated action, and especially in terms of coordinated military action, will probably fall far short of anything we might view as an alliance, right? So it's more of a four-sided marriage of convenience, which is not uncommon in international politics, right? When you share a common threat, states are going to get together and think about how they can pursue it. But I guess I am slightly, or I just be cautious with respect to how quickly it will develop and how sort of deep the security cooperation will be, because, you know, these are four different countries dispersed over a pretty wide geographic area. And although it's very clear that they share common concerns with China and its rise, what that means in practice in terms of some kind of a de facto alignment or alliance, I think remains to be seen.
Oh, that's really interesting. So we are kind of running out of time, but just before we go, I want to bring it back to the China-India question and just ask you, you know, what do you think we're going to see over the next couple of months, over the next couple of years? I know you mentioned that if we don't see much more movement before winter, we might just start back up in the spring. But I guess, how concerned should we be that this is going to spiral out of control in some way?
Well, I think the probability of escalation increased pretty significantly in the last 2 weeks, because the move that India made was significant, and it has brought forces into close proximity with each other when, even though it was not complete, there had certainly been some disengagement after June. That being said, I think China has clearly signaled it does not want to escalate further. It sent these signals in the immediate aftermath of the violence in June, but also more recently at the foreign ministers meeting in, I think it was Moscow, where China has tried to sort of say in multiple times, even before that meeting, or you've seen this in Chinese statements over the summer, that they don't want to see the dispute harming the broader relationship with India. So I think China realizes that even if they've already nudged India closer to the U.S., that they could probably push it even closer, which would ultimately come at their sort of long-term expense. And so at the political level, you do have, I think, this desire from China not to escalate further, but it doesn't translate necessarily into a unilateral disengagement on the border either, right? And so I think the real worry is that the movement forces on the ground could create a situation or a crisis or a clash, then becomes much harder to control at the political level. But if one starts at the political level with respect to China, one does not see signs that China is going to try to escalate further and make any quick gains before winter sets in. Winter may be a proverbial cooling off period, and that may then allow both sides to kind of reconsider what they want to do in the spring when the ice melts. India's position is that China has to, or India's position is that they want the status quo ante of April 2020 to be restored. And one view for why India made this move at the end of August was basically to get some leverage over China, such that you could now have a much more meaningful disengagement, because presumably in exchange for China vacating the areas that it moved into after April 2020, India would also vacate these areas. And then you would kind of have a deal that could be made, right? Whereas up until this point, India has kind of been asking China to move back, and China's hasn't had a strong reason to, other than wanting to maintain, you know, or to prevent a complete deterioration of ties with India. And so perhaps the winter, when it really, one can't do much on the ground, provides an opportunity to figure out what this deal might look like without also at the same time having to worry about potential for escalation. But at the moment, I mean, if these reports coming out of India are accurate, right, if you're only a couple hundred meters apart, you're well armed, you're firing warning shots, right? This is a situation that really does harken back to the summer of 1962. When basically you had this slow moving but steady escalation with increasing deployments by both sides that ultimately led to a few small firefights and then a large scale war in October.
Well, certainly something we're going to keep a close eye on over the next couple of months. So thank you so much for joining us today, Taylor.
No, thank you for having me.
And thanks as always to our production team, Tyler Shanahan, Cecil Sherman, and Lauren Sander. Thanks to you all at home for listening. And if you want to continue the conversation, you can find us on Twitter at Power Problems. And if you like the show, please leave us a good review on iTunes or wherever else you find your podcasts.